Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
Donald McLean was a star diplomat, an establishment insider, and a keeper of some of the West's greatest secrets. He was also a Russian spy, driven by passionately held beliefs whose betrayal and defection to Moscow reverberated for decades. Christened orphan by his Russian recruiter, McLean was the perfect spy and Britain's most gifted traitor. But as he leaked huge amounts of top secret intelligence, an international code-breaking operation was closing rapidly on him. Moments before he was unmasked, McLean vanished. It's the subject of a fascinating new biography by Roland Phillips called A Spy Named Orphan. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK. Roland Phillips, author of A Spy Named Orphan. Roland, good morning to you.
Good morning.
It's a fascinating tale. It's perhaps the best known tale of the Cold War, the so-called Cambridge spies. Tell us a little bit more about McLean, because he wasn't a toff. He wasn't of the establishment.
He wasn't of the establishment, but he looked and behaved like he was of the establishment, and I think that was the reason that the establishment and the secret services failed to catch him, even when they'd been told there'd been a spy at a very high level in the embassy in Washington in the Second World War, British embassy. They completely failed to recognize it was McLean until irrefutable evidence was put in front of them, and even then they couldn't quite believe it. But because he went to private school and to Cambridge, and because his father had been a cabinet minister, and because he was very tall and wore beautiful suits and a bow tie, they assumed that he was of the establishment, and that was why they failed to spot him. Whereas, in fact, his father had been all but born in the Scottish Croft and had worked his way up to become an MP and a cabinet minister, and he was the first generation of his family to go to university. So it was a... he was hiding in plain sight the whole time.
Hiding in plain sight, a good way of putting it. McLean first became, as many of his generation did, interested in politics and communism in the 30s, during what was going on with the Spanish Civil War, the Bolsheviks, that kind of thing?
Absolutely. The Spanish Civil War, a bit before the Spanish Civil War, he first became a communist when he was at Cambridge in the early 30s with the depression underway and the hunger marches going to from the north of England to London, and most particularly the rise of fascism, which of course led to the Spanish Civil War, and Hitler coming to power and Mussolini coming to power. So it's a combination of factors that led him and many others to believe that communism was the only path to world peace, to have the work to do away with the old system that had led to the First World War and the Depression, and that communism should be the way ahead. So his first Foreign Office, he joined the Foreign Office in 1935, and he did serve on the Non-Intervention Committee during the Spanish Civil War. The British policy was of non-intervention, so he was, I suspect, in agony having to pass on the have paperwork on all the atrocities that were going on in Spain.
And how was he recruited then by the NKVD, which was later become the KGB, a brutal and ruthless organisation under, was it Barrow who was the head of the NKVD at that point?
A little later he became head of it. But how he was recruited, there was a brilliant psychologist who'd studied psychology in Vienna who came to England. Vienna got too hot to hold him. And he took a psychological line on his recruits, and he identified four ideal traits of a recruit: a predilection for secretiveness, a inherent class resentfulness, and above all, a need for praise and reassurance, which is what MacLean had throughout his life. And all the Cambridge spies had issues with their fathers and doting mothers, and so sort of cheap psychology takes you to being recruited. So he was recruited before and after that period. Recruits to spies were trapped or blackmailed, honey trapped or blackmailed. But for a brief window, this man, Arnold Deutsch, he was called, could pick up the ideologues by going to the top universities, in this case Cambridge, and working out which young communists might go to the top of their professions, at which point they could start disavowing their communism, and everyone would say, oh, that was a university folly. So he was remarkably successful. He got MacLean, who was going to the top of the Foreign Office, Anthony Blunt, who became Keeper of the Queen's Pictures, Philby, who went to the top of MI6. I mean, he was a genius, psychological genius.
And, of course, with the outbreak of the Second World War, Britain becomes an ally of the Soviet Union, and I suppose MacLean could feel that he was doing for king and country as well as helping his Soviet paymasters.
Absolutely, and he absolutely did believe that, and it's noticeable that after the war, when the Cold War began in earnest, he began to fall apart, rather. One thing about MacLean was he was a fantastic patriot, worked hugely hard in the Foreign Office, would have gone right to the top. He was also the most productive spy the Russians had. He gave away literally thousands of documents. He worked heroically hard at both his jobs. And during the war, he was able to hold the two together. After the war, as the Cold War got going, and when he was giving away astonishing secrets about American atomic capability, for example, and he gave away the whole shape of the borders of Europe as Churchill and Roosevelt would be negotiating it at the conferences towards the end of the war. But after the war, he began to fall apart. He began drinking very, very heavily. He went on epic binges, which ended up with his trying to throttle his wife on a boat trip up the Nile, breaking a fellow diplomat's leg, and eventually trashing an American diplomat's flat in 1950, at which point he was sent home. And I believe that this tension between his spying and his diplomacy work became unbearable for him. And he was a very tormented figure, but he kept going because he still believed that communism was the only way to get world peace.
I mean, how much damage can you estimate then that this was doing in because he was in Washington in 94, and we're not talking of somebody sort of lower down the order, we're talking top level secrets that he was giving
absolutely
away.
Absolutely, top level secrets. It was found out that he was, I mean, in the mid-40s, it was found out that the spy, they hadn't yet identified him, had given away all the Yalta Conference negotiating positions. For example, there's a telegram where Churchill and Roosevelt agree that the borders of Poland, they ideally would be in one place, but if Molotov, the Russian foreign minister, insisted, they'd move them 200 miles to the west. So he, in knowing that, of course, gave the Russians the upper hand in the negotiating positions. That's just one example of the many ways he affected the post-war outcome. He gave away the Marshall Plan. He had an access all area pass to the Atomic Energy Commission in Washington, D.C., so he could say exactly how many bombs the Americans were capable of building which was far less than they were claiming. And actually, ironically, in that way, I think he did preserve the peace, but he did enable the Russians, gave the Russians, all of his spying in this period, I think, gave the Russians confidence. It gave them confidence in negotiation, confidence in building their atom bombs, and confidence in their shaping Europe. I mean, they knew, for example, they knew that NATO was being formed and exactly what the negotiation was going on. So it just enabled them to the Soviets to know exactly what the Americans and British were thinking, which is, you can ask no more of a espionage network.
Could you argue then that perhaps he is the most damaging spy then, or gave a, he was the if you can say it, he was the most productive spy, more so than Blunt, more so than Burgess?
Yes, I do argue that very strongly in the book. What he gave away in that period was critical to the shape of post-war Europe. He didn't have anyone. Philby had, people died as a result of Philby's actions. That wasn't the case with Maclean. It was very, very high-level diplomacy. But I do think he was the most important spy of the Cambridge Five and of that period, without a doubt.
I mean, Maclean managed to keep, if you like, keep it all together despite, you know, his deterioration in Cairo, which was perhaps the worst place you could send somebody like him to, because he didn't like Empire either.
And
this is just before the Aden, you know, the whole the Egypt fiasco.
Yes.
How did he manage to keep under the radar, and as the net closed in, was it the MI6 and to a certain the Americans were so paranoid about security, they were both as, if you like, as hopeless as each other?
Well, the Americans weren't hopeless. The Americans, through this remarkable code-breaking operation, pointed out to the British that they'd had a spy in Washington in the war, from decoding fragments of Russian telegrams going to Moscow. But the British reaction to that, was able to stay under the radar for so long because the British reaction to that was, and the head of security in the Foreign Office, there's a memo in the National Archives in Britain saying, it won't be a senior man, we must look at any secretaries who had nervous breakdowns around that time. So that was their mindset. It couldn't possibly be, even though none of the diplomats had been vetted at that point. Vetting only came in after Maclean defected. They simply couldn't believe it could be one of their own, one of their class, and so on. And so that was how he was able to fly under the radar. And by the same token, when these terrifying alcoholic binges were taking place in Cairo, none of it got back onto his file, even when he, because they simply couldn't believe that a man who was such a good diplomat could be capable of such things. And even when he'd come home suffering from a nervous breakdown, as it was put, his deputy in the embassy in Cairo was writing to a friend in London, blaming Maclean's American wife. He says, you know how these Americans like to hit it up. So even when he was crashing out, they were blaming his wife and seeing him as immaculate and wanting him back on his feet, which they did get him back on his feet just and made him head of the American Department in London just at the beginning of the Korean War. I mean, so that was, they had absolutely no idea. And yet they'd been looking for the spy for 2.5 years by this time.
And then in 1951... both he and Burgess disappear, and nothing is heard from Maclean until he resurfaces 5 years later at a Soviet press conference.
That's right. So he disappears in 1951. It's assumed he's gone to Russia, but no one hears from him. What struck me as extraordinary in that period was the way they all gathered round his wife and three very young children. One of them was born just after he disappeared, and said the poor woman who knew nothing about it. But in fact, 2 years later, she too disappeared just after Stalin died, I think not coincidentally, because it was safe then. And she disappeared and went and joined him, and then nobody heard from them at all. And I think there's a very real possibility, certainly in those first 2 years, that they might have been killed. They outlived their usefulness as spies. Stalin was paranoid about anyone who'd served abroad. But then when Khrushchev was coming to Britain on a tour in his sort of in his world tour effectively of 1956, such a great pressure was put on him. He was told by his own side that if he didn't reveal the missing diplomats, as they were known, then that would be the only thing he'd be asked when he came to Britain. So he did make them appear at a press conference in Moscow. And after which, McLean took on a different name. Burgess basically drank himself to death, but McLean went back to work in foreign policy. He worked in a think tank under a different name, so attention wouldn't be drawn to him. He called himself Mark Fraser and became completely Russian and sober, and his life wasn't divided, and he was a lot happier.
Because we have the stories, Philby, Burgess, you know, that once a Soviet spy has outlived his usefulness, you imagine them doing what they did. Philby, you know, Burgess drinking himself to death, Philby living in splendid isolation and becoming the subject of documentaries and Englishmen Abroad and all that.
Yes.
Why do you think what were the shockwaves like in the West then when he resurfaced?
There was sort of relief. First of all, there was relief that what they thought had happened to him had happened to him, that he'd gone to Russia. But then there was a terrific, I suppose there was a witch hunt as to how they could have got away. Because at the point where McLean went, they knew absolutely he was the spy. They had a plan to bring him in a few weeks, if not months' time, but they were really dragging their heels. I believe it was the beginning of the end of the establishment in that period. The word was coined to talk about those in that usage, to talk about people that protected McLean throughout his career. And I think that became a very big issue in 56. And then following on, it went through other spy cases. Philby was uncovered, Blake, the Profumo scandal. And I think these were all... McLean's defection was the first nail in the establishment coffin that maybe culminated in the Profumo scandal and the downfall of the Macmillan government.
Why do you think the time was right then to write this book now, in this new age, as it were?
The time was right. Well, partly because of the interest in Russia now, and that Russia is once again penetrating the West at a very high level, as we see from the American election and so on, although that report has yet to come out. But also, I started writing the book because the papers were finally released into the National Archives. They were held up long beyond when they should have been released, and I think it was because of establishment embarrassment, because of the tale it tells of people not spotting McLean. So it was a combination of what we're seeing every day now around Russia, as well as the establishment finally deciding they should give up these rather embarrassing secrets.
Do you think history will be kind, if you're old, kinder to McLean than the other the double agents that MI5 had, because he was a more complex, if you like, figure?
I believe it will, and I think now, when I was thinking about him, I realised he's a very modern figure in many ways. I mean, he was anti-colonial, he was anti-capitalist, he believed in world peace, and that's what sustained him, whereas when the others sort of started to fall apart, when he actually put himself back together, he was sustained by this strong ideology that we should... we should work together, and communism can lead to peace. So I think in that way he's much more modern than the others, and that history will be kind. I came to admire his strength of conscience and integrity that kept him going throughout his life, and I think that's rather remarkable.
Well, did you speak to any of his contemporaries or anybody in MO5, and is he still looked upon as a figure of you know, repulsion?
There are very few of his contemporaries alive. I mean, he disappeared 67 years ago.
Yeah.
Age 38. So very, very few people knew him. I did find in family papers of the McLean family, there were a lot of letters when he died in 1983 to his family here from his friends in England, who were all They felt very betrayed by him. They weren't disgusted by him because they admired. I mean, he didn't make any secret of his left-wingness, though he obviously didn't let on he was a spy. But they admired that integrity that I was just talking about, although they felt personally very betrayed when he went.
The book is called A Spy Named Orphan, The Enigma of Donald MacLean. It's out now by Bodley Head. It's by Roland Phillips. Roland, if people want to find out more information, do you have a website yourself? Is there social media?
Bodley Head website, the Penguin website, will tell them a lot more.
And we only ask the question, after dealing with A Spy Named Orphan, what's your next project?
My next project, I'm not revealing yet, but it's to do with patriotism and ideology and the relation between them, and it's another Cold War story.
We'll look forward to speaking to you when you reveal that one then. Roland Phillips, it's been a real pleasure to speak to you this morning.
Thank you so much.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date, it notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.